you don't have to love my right wing point of view, but right wingers need love too. One more time, here we go. Right wingers need love too. We all need love, indeed we do. Now you don't have to love my right wing point of view, but right wingers need love. Right wingers need love. Right wingers need love too.
Social contract. I didn't sign no stinking social contract. Friends, Romans, Kentuckians, bitter clingers, anarchists, holy rolling bootleggers, leg lickers, pinkos, union thugs, freak brothers, and tea partiers. Howdy, neighbors. This is Lonesome Al Barger, your friendly neighborhood right-wing nut job. Here this day of our Lord, January the 13th of 2013. Look, I'm so far out there that I make that evil Margaret Thatcher sound like the sainted Fidel Castro. I'm just that much of a wingnut. But any halfway to thoughtful or even semi-educated person who is not completely blinded by ideology from being willing to recognize the complexities and tough choices of the real world outside of our churches, college dorms, faculty lounges, and other religious enclaves really has to have mixed feelings about all kinds of things, political and otherwise. For example, I am moved to speak to you today because, frankly, I have mixed feelings about the United States Constitution. I ran for the U.S. Senate in 2004 under the auspices and rules of the Constitution. I think that it's a brilliant document and probably the best piece of written statecraft in human history that I know of. I speak in favor of it all the time and invoke its authority against particularly egregious usurpers of power like El Presidente Barack Obama as he works tirelessly to turn America into a third world country. But at some point, I don't really believe in the U.S. Constitution, which pretty much is a way of saying that I don't believe in any such thing as there being a legitimate moral responsibility to obey the government per se, any government. The Constitution is not the revealed word of the living God, if you even believe in any such thing, and politicians and officials operating under the Constitution are even more prone to corruption than our priests under the Bible. This brings me to one of the immovable posts of my early education, a treatise written shortly after the Civil War called No Treason, The Constitution of No Authority by Lysander Spooner. I was already taking to libertarian philosophy like the proverbial duck to water when I first read this short book as a teenager. It is very well known and highly controversial, even in hardcore libertarian circles. Among other things, it is the clearest dividing line between sensible, limited government constitutionalists versus just plain damn crazy anarchist. Spooner's basic argument is that the United States Constitution is not even vaguely a legitimate social contract that anyone is morally bound to obey, nor would it be recognized as a legal contract in any other context. Starting from the premise that we are all born free men, Lysander Spooner says, in short, social contract. I didn't sign no stinking social contract. He's right, and he proves it. Spooner breaks it down in a simple and passionate but careful lawyerly fashion that absolutely cannot reasonably be denied. He begins, quote, "The Constitution has no inherent authority or obligation. It has no authority or obligation at all, unless as a contract between man and man," end quote. Then he takes that premise to court with unassailable logic. This is some kind of contract that was written by people dead for now hundreds of years who never themselves signed the thing. How is this a legitimate binding contract that I am supposedly morally or legally bound to follow in the 21st century? He breaks that down real thorough and if you accept the basic premise that we are born free individuals and are not the property of the government, then you simply cannot deny his conclusion. And if you do think that my conscience and consciousness belong to someone besides me, you'll have to tell me why I should accept another man as my master. Further, Spooner makes a pretty convincing argument that the U.S. Constitution is a terrible deal that no one ever would really understand and then voluntarily sign. Quote, because as his only chance of self-preservation, a man uses a ballot, is it to be inferred that the contest is one into which he voluntarily entered, that he voluntarily set up all his own natural rights as a stake against those of others to be lost or won by the mere power of numbers, end quote. Well, gee, when you say it that way, of course, no sane person, liberal, conservative, or Pentecostal bootlegger would willingly sign such a thing. Duh. All illusions of piety and freedom aside, though, you know, and I know, that government is a gussied-up mafia contract. It's Vito Corleone's offer that you can't refuse. This is not ideological opinion or interpretation on my part. It is simply an observation of the real facts of life on the ground. If you try to say different, you're simply lying to yourself. Spooner broke that all down and proved it with unassailable logic. I feel strongly enough about this that I have published the entire No Constitution treatise and created a near 2.5-hour audiobook of Spooner's 20,000-word text, which is readily available for download at my morethings.com domain. It felt really good reading that aloud, by the way. I suggest you all try it for yourself, especially sometime when you got a belly full of good Kentucky moonshine. But even when I was a teenager, inexperienced and thus at my most ideologically pure, I had to ask the basic obvious question, okay, Spooner's right on, man. But how is this supposed to actually work on the ground? How could a society operate without any authority structure? In Robert Heinlein's metaphor, we are collectively tied to having a government, nasty as that is at best, much like we are individually required to have bowels and poop. But even Spooner didn't seem to quite consider himself an anarchist. He talks repeatedly, even in No Treason, about quote-unquote courts of justice. But under what authority would such a court operate? Does just anybody that can afford some robes and gavel set themselves up a court, hauling people off when they do wrong, and by what standards of law? I probably wouldn't much care for courts bankrolled by Exxon or George Soros. I might return to a Mormon court for some justice, but then the Mormons produced Harry Reid, so who are you going to trust? And how are these courts going to get paid for, especially the parts about locking people up? That's expensive, but there are some folk who obviously can't be running around on the streets. Predators have to be dealt with. Or maybe the Court of Justice just shoots people who are too dangerous to run loose. I could maybe get behind that as a cost-cutting measure, and also as a humane measure, preferable to a long, miserable prison sentence. But one way or another, we functionally have to have some minimum of structured authority for basic courts and prisons to arbitrate the enforcement of contracts and deal with predatory individuals. Can't really escape that in any way that I can see. Also, there are a couple of specific points where I definitely have to call bullshit on Spooner. Two or three different places in this essay, he talks about someone not wanting to pay a government to protect him when they feel perfectly capable of protecting themselves. Okay, maybe you could more think that way in 1870, but even then there were bad guys and Muslim pirates and foreign governments ready to kill us. even a bunch of bitter clingers with the dreaded AR-15 assault rifles could not deal individually or as an informal local co-op with Hitler and Hirohito or Al-Qaeda or nuclear North Korea. That's going to take U.S. Marines, and it's going to take more than bake sales and passing the hat to pay for it. Also, Spooner comes to a big final proposal that sounds good as a sentence, but is really just nonsense in any consideration of actual practice. Spooner's ultimate answer to Lincoln and Grant was, quote, "If their object had really been to abolish slavery or maintain liberty or justice generally, they had only to say, all, whether white or black, who want the protection of this government shall have it, and all who do not want it will be left in peace, so long as they leave us in peace. Had they said this, slavery would necessarily have been abolished at once. The war would have been saved in a thousand times nobler union than we have ever had would have been the result." End quote. By way of just a brief rebuttal, how exactly would that work in practice, which is the standard that all ideals ultimately have to answer to? So then, let's say that Hildy, a slave on the candy plantation in Chickasaw County, Mississippi, says, "Why, yes, Mr. Spooner, I would like your noble government's protection, pretty please." How exactly does Mr. Spooner's noble union protect this constituent customer in a manner that does not involve Sherman marching brutally towards the sea? You say you want a revolution. We'd all love to see the plan. Looking at human nature and behavior, I don't see how you could get by without at least some centralized government and some kind of taxation to pay for these minimal needful functions. This was the clear strategic goal behind the construction of the U.S. Constitution, which is part of why the document is praiseworthy, despite the fact that, yes, it produced, among other monsters, Abe Lincoln and Woodrow Wilson. It was designed and intended to keep the government on as short a leash as practically and functionally possible. The instrument is very carefully designed to grind the gears that it creates against one another, purposely created friction between states versus federal government, executive versus legislative versus judicial branches, a divided congressional structure, and a long list of specific stuff that no level of government is allowed to do. Again, Spooner has very good, legitimate points that not even the relatively best government has a real right to morally demand general obedience. And yes, a tax collector is just like a highwayman or a carjacker, only far worse. Also, it stinks that we have to have bowels that put out smelly poopy. But what are you going to do? Quit pooping? Pretty soon you'll be reduced to being a congressman or a preacher. Also, consider that Spooner's idea at that point of the protection provided by the U.S. Constitution was Sherman's still recent march to the sea and the ongoing so-called Reconstruction. Spooner's cynicism is understandable. Abe Lincoln was the American Satan, probably the wickedest president we ever had, just based on his actions. So Spooner simply and way too conveniently rhetorically declares that he don't need no stinking protection. Well, no, we don't need honest Abe killing a 500,000 people in the war of northern aggression. But that doesn't mean that there aren't enemies, foreign and domestic, from whom we now need defending. We can argue about the particulars, but we have to have a pretty serious military where there are bunches of predatory governments and pirates that would swoop in and tear us up for all kinds of reasons of profit and spite. Again, that's just recognizing human nature. It's nice to say that if we just leave people alone, they'll leave us alone. But in the reality of human history, sometimes that works, and sometimes it simply does not. Now, Maybe someday we'll evolve up into becoming Stanley Kubrick's Star Child, and we won't have to have governments or bowels, and we can just run on electricity or orgone energy or LSD pills. That sounds like fun. In the meantime, though, we're going to need toilets and governments. Also, while we're chatting here so enjoyably about whether or why to tolerate any government at all, a majority of Americans believe in Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and all kinds of other free crap. And they don't see why we shouldn't just take all the rich people's stuff to give it away to poor people, such as themselves. From each according to ability, to each according to need, or spreading the wealth around, as President Obama famously explained it to Joe the Plumber. Basically, Marxist and Obama-type philosophies simply make greed, thieving, and gangsterism into moral virtues. As long as most people in the country believe, as they do now, that it's acceptable for the government to redistribute the wealth, to steal in the name of the people or the needy or God, then we'll never have the peace and freedom we should have. The idea of the abstract term freedom gets pretty seriously twisted, even in America, home of James Madison and Ayn Rand. People proclaim the freedom to grab people's guns because they don't like them, the freedom to ban weed because it's not good for people to get high and giggle, the freedom to ban toys and Happy Meals to supposedly discourage kids from bad eating habits, or the freedom to tell people that they can't drill for oil or farm their own land because it might hurt, insert name of obscure rodent or bug here. So I end up, I suppose, retreating to support for the U.S. Constitution as a compromise. It's written with the right animating idea of being suspicious of government power and carefully describing a few minimal responsibilities recognized as legitimate. If a good portion of the public would understand and support the basic principles and limitations described in relatively clear and simple language by James Madison et al., we'd be in great shape. If we could just manage to halfway force the government to stick to those written limits, it would be halfway tolerable to live with. But then, the government is tolerable to live with now. Because, like I said, it's an offer you can't refuse. You can tolerate and work with the system, or you can rebel and be jailed or shot. The whole public is off kilter from reality or morality so far that they elect and re-elect the likes of Barack Obama, which re-election, by the way, is the most proximate cause of me now wanting to revisit my whole commitment to this Constitution business. I mean to say, what good is any constitutional structure through which we could get Obamacare? Just for the tip of the iceberg. Thus, I am, to a certain extent, sympathetic to anarchist or the secessionist sentiments that bubbled up immediately after Obama's re-election. In the theory, I might support, say, Indiana seceding from the Union. But it's so not going to happen, and you just look like a moron for talking about it. As Senator Phil Graham once put it, you should never take a hostage that you are not prepared to shoot. So, unless you are seriously ready to go all John Brown and absolutely throw away your life to take up arms against the U.S. government, shut up with the secessionist talk. The Civil War pretty well settled any real talk of secession or insurrection. But, then again, short of overthrowing the whole dad-blame government, there is the possibility of dealing more discreetly with specific, particularly egregious officials. Such thinking was more commonplace in earlier times. In my ancestral home of Kentucky, particularly, being a revenuer looking for a hillbilly's moonshine still was deadly serious business. Partly because it is a really wonderful song, and indeed the official theme song of my morethings.com website. I'm going to take 2 minutes to play a probably 50-plus-year-old recording called There'll Be Moonshine in Them Old Kentucky Hills by Dave Aikman, who was better known by his stage name String Bean and made his bones in Bill Monroe's band.
Up in the eastern part of Kentucky, up there in the hills where I come from, there's always been moonshine all over up there. Look like every time they tear up one steel, there's always two to take its place. Now, there's a place over there called Ross's Creek. Now, Ross's Creek was a funny place. There's just one way you could get in there, and there wasn't no way you could get out. That is, if you're a lawman. I'll never forget one time there's two revenue men come up there and asked my little brother, said, now, we take this road over the hill. Said, where will it take us to? My little brother says, it'll take you to my Paul Steele, but it won't bring me back. He said, now, if you go down and show us where your Paul Steele is, we'll give you a dollar when we get back. My little brother said, you give me the dollar before you go, because when you go down there, you ain't coming back.
Yeah, bright lights and Broadway, sunshine down Dixie, there'll be moonshine of old Kentucky hills. Golden hills, beautiful hills, there'll be moonshine of old Kentucky hills. Yeah, bright lights and Broadway, sunshine down Dixie, there'll be moonshine of old Kentucky hills. Got duties to perform. But since my man's been elected, moonshine down to be protected, there'll be moonshine of old Kentucky hills. Golden hills, beautiful hills, there'll be moonshine of old Kentucky hills. Yeah, bright lights and Broadway, sunshine down to Dixie, there'll be moonshine of old Kentucky hills.
Yeah. Now, besides the righteous banjo picking, though, consider this sentimental song as perhaps rather a rich rumination on a type of federalism. Consider on this local county sheriff elected to protect the bootleggers. Note especially the story at the front about the little brother who wants to be paid his $1 for pointing the revenuers toward his pappy still in advance. Wonder how such sheriffs considered and reconciled themselves to such deadly practices. Personally, though, I know better than even just talking back to cops. Officer Friendly stopped me last week for nothing whatsoever except not wearing a frickin' seatbelt. After inconveniencing me badly and writing me a $25 ticket for this bogus nonsense, he says in parting, "You be safe." I can hardly express how galling it was, not just to get screwed with, but then have him acting as if he was really just looking out for my safety. I wanted to say his words back to him, but I caught myself. If I'd have said, "You be safe too, officer," I'm afraid that I would not have been able to artificially conjure the right inflection in my voice, and it might have ended up involving a SWAT team or something else very unpleasant. Now, besides old Hal venting, the point of that story be that I'm too honest to come out pretending to be a revolutionary. I'm just a poor country boy trying to make my way in a cold, hard world and figure on how people can get along enough to live peaceable with each other. So I surely got no interest in committing suicide by cop. Why would anyone want to be Cool Hand Luke? But mostly you have to follow the law, and some of the main stuff you should follow with or without cops watching. If you want to have any kind of community where you can live without being robbed, raped, and beaten, then you have to expect to reciprocate. If you insist on pillaging and raping, eventually we the people or just one would-be victim is going to have to stop you. So it is good to cooperate with the enforcement of legitimate basic natural law that you have to leave me alone if you want to be left alone. Now, I want to speak very carefully here. by natural law, I do not mean to invoke some ordination by God or even really a moral obligation, though there is that, but that's a little bit different question. That is, I'm separating the very different basic philosophical issues of personal ethics versus politics, what you should choose to do versus what you should have to do under force of law. It's just a basic playground understanding. If you don't want other kids beating you down, you need to play at least halfway to nice. I'm perfectly happy to cooperate with that much governance and give them pretty much understanding and leeway to establish such basic practical needs in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, and promote the general welfare. But that doesn't mean that I have any legitimate moral compulsion to follow just any stupid law that some legislature or even worse, some unelected bureaucrat comes up with. Really? By what logic would the fact that Barack Obama managed to get 50.5% of the secret vote of a secret gang of thieves ethically oblige me to do what he says when his gendarmes are not watching? Just for a specific example of specious moral presumption of law, I want to take a moment to criticize Greg Garrison. Garrison is an attorney and former prosecutor who runs a fine radio talk show on WIBC out of Indianapolis. But I was cussing the radio a couple of weeks ago when he presumed to shame a perfectly nice caller because he's a contractor who routinely hires undocumented Mexicans and South Americans. Some of the local native-born are willing to halfway work for a while if he'll call them back in 3 weeks when their unemployment benefits run out. Instead, he hires Mexicans who want to work, who are willing to work now and hard. So Greg Garrison says to this guy, quote, shame on you. He basically said, shame on you for breaking the law. That's about when I started cussing Brother Garrison. The caller might want to be careful about what consequences there could be if the wrong government thugs caught him giving honest work to people the United States government doesn't approve of. You need to think about the practical consequences of your actions before you figure on going into even a perfectly legitimate enterprise such as selling weed. The true statement that this law is unjust will not serve as a legal argument that will keep you out of prison if you are caught. But Brother Garrison can get well and truly bent if he thinks I should feel guilty for hiring a guy to work for me and paying him honest wages that we have agreed to between us. It's none of his or the government's legitimate damn business. But your understanding of what you believe to be your legitimate moral obligations is nonetheless crucial to guiding your actions 100 times a day when there's no cop or boss or parent watching you. Those hundreds of times hundreds of millions of people are most of what gives us a good or bad country or community, workplace or family. Free your mind and the rest will follow, the saying goes. Well, now I don't know about all that. But if you have your own mind bound and tied in illegitimate and illusory chains of presumed moral obligations, then there's definitely no freedom for you anywhere. A good close consideration of Lysander Spooner's No Treason can go a long way toward at least freeing your mind. And that's where you really live. See also St. Ayn Rand, particularly her ruminations on the sanction of the victim. And the more people who disbelieve and throw off these illusory bonds of mental and moral servitude, the harder to oppress us all. So then, ultimately, the Constitution is not really holy writ, but a tool. Merely the chain with which we try, not very successfully, to restrain the beast. We seem to have to try to convince people that the chain really is holy writ, that has some magical, mystical power and authority. Because people don't seem to be able to believe in ideas sensible-like without making a damn religion out of them. Thus, you may as well try to convince the most uneducated, backwater, hillbilly, holy roller in Jackson, Mississippi on a Saturday night to disbelieve the resurrection of Jesus Christ, as to try to convince a brilliant PhD Marxist president or college professor that socialism and communism are bad ideas, even with the evidence of Stalin and Chairman Mao and modern Greece, for starters. People, what are you going to do with them? Well, I'm about through pontificating on man and God and law for the moment. I reckon I'm about ranted out now. I feel a lot better now that I've vented my bitter, clinging, right-wing hatred and resentment against all things decent, sociable, and socialistic. Before I run out of breath, though, I want to stop for a moment in the gratitude corner to show some appreciation for the air, the sunshine, and the rain. I thank the Lord for 1,000 points of light, including Lysander Spooner, St. Ayn, James Madison, and Nina Simone, for pointing out that despite goddamn Mississippi and them mean old backlash blues of the 20th century, tomorrow is the 22nd century. I can't wait. I also want to send some love out to the good people of Mississippi, as they have coincidentally come up on the bad end of several of my examples today. Besides anything else, though, Mississippi was the birthplace of Robert Lee Roy Johnson and Elvis Aaron Presley, and even just those two are a pretty substantial contribution to the world. Also, let's not forget Jerry Clower, who is one of my role models in the art of rhetoric as practiced in these Owlcasts. I thank Dr. BLT for the Right Wingers theme song. That plus String Bean, Robert Johnson, and a bunch more of my finely rounded rhetorical ruminations can be found on the electronic interweb at www.morethings.com, MoreThings.com. I thank you for listening, and I hope I've done your brain a little bit of good.